Well, Peter, I'm delighted to see you, but I would like the people that I talk to were mainly physicians, but it's spreading largely due to Craig. I'd like you to introduce yourself a little bit more to them. I do a lot of work for you, by the way, selling your books. You're very popular in evangelical medical circles, and I'm going to take credit for that for a considerable degree. But I lost my way as a Christian, not in terms of belief, but in terms of not practicing my faith. Did you go through such an experience?
I think we all are in such an experience. If we practiced our faith, we would all be saints.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. We have children who lose their way completely. I belonged to a little Bible study group when I went to medical school initially. And some years later, I could only find two people from that group who were still willing to call themselves Christian.
Wow.
Now, looking back over that story, I came from a very humble blue-collar background, but the Bible was central to our family. It was read at least twice every day. And so all that was put in my mind before I had any idea what was happening or even what a mind was.
Yeah.
Did you have a similar background?
Very similar. Protestant evangelical, Dutch Calvinist. Yeah, we knew the Bible.
And that's an incredible gift, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Those early years when what goes in sticks and stays forever. I was blown away some years ago by an American academic, Bruce Waltke, who's a theologian, Old Testament theologian. And he gave some lectures on covenants in Ottawa. And I had never thought about the Shema at all. But he really got to me, especially the role of the dining room table, so to speak, and daily life and its integration with Scripture. And
yeah.
When you ask people nowadays, can you tell me what follows? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength. I rarely get the right answer.
Right. Well, the Bible and the dining room table are two of the things that are collapsing, and that's why Western civilization is collapsing.
What can we do about it?
I don't know. A lot of people come up with answers, some of them positive and optimistic, some of them negative and pessimistic. I suppose all we can do is follow our marching orders and let God pick up the pieces. I mean, the meaning of life is to become a saint.
Yes, yes. In the more Catholic sense, whereas in your early days, everybody was a saint who believed, and both are true, of course, in different ways. But what got to me over time, as I spent more time with children, was what follows the well-known bit of loving God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength. It's these things shall be upon your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children when you rise up, when you lie down, etc. And later in the chapter, he does something which is very, lovely for a pediatrician to suddenly realize very late in his life. He says, when your son asks you for reasons for why we go to church, don't use authority. Don't say, get in the car, which is what most of us did on Sunday morning. He says, tell him the story. We were slaves in Egypt, etc., etc. And up to about the age of seven, children acknowledge that sort of thing easily. But they're watching us, and by about the age of seven, they've learned that we're all hypocrites.
Well, I think Satan has got smart today. In the past, he used reason and lost the theologians. Now he's not using reason anymore to question what reason do we have for believing has become almost a disreputable question. I remember when I first came to Boston College, I had dinner with some of the Jesuits there, and I said to them, I looked through your list of courses in the school catalog, and I saw a lot of variety, but I saw nothing in apologetics. And they said, oh, we don't do apologetics anymore. That's old-fashioned. I was just a neophyte, so I didn't dare say why, because you have nothing to share. You can't get what you don't have, so you can't defend a faith that you don't have, but that was the case, at least with that group. And I think the theologian's attack on the historicity of the Gospels is far more than an academic exercise. If the story isn't true, if it isn't literally true that Jesus rose from the dead, then all the values just disappear into thin air.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And the things they are doing to blows your mind every time you look at it. The ethics courses in medical schools, for instance, they're a relatively recent thing. When I went to medical school, we had no ethics courses. We trusted one another to a considerable degree, and we inhabited a narrative of responsibility for patients, which came before everything else. That, of course, is no longer true. We did trust one another. Now we don't. In the last 2 or 3 years, I ask the question often, but I've got down to a stage when the answer to the question, how many people do you trust in your medical classes, has got down to zero more than once.
Well, ethics, as it's now taught, sometimes does more harm than good. I call it remember your boots ethics. If it's raining outside, you tell the children to put their rubbers or galoshes or boots on in order to protect themselves. And that's what ethics is, an afterthought. Oh, after you get finished with the really important thing, remember not to do this and that.
Yeah, yes, it's terrible. The denial of the fact value distinction to me is absolutely stunning. It is so blatantly obvious. And the example you've just given, the only way they get out of it is to use a prudential value to pretend that they can get a true subjunctive, which they can't.
Prudential in the narrow sense of utilitarian, yes. We are the first society in the entire history of the world, the majority of whose mind molders, both formal in education and informal in media, no longer believe in the Tao or the natural law or objective morality or the connection between facts and values.
Yeah.
We don't have a very happy future, I think. And the collapse of Western civilization will be a great blessing to the rest of the world.
And to us, probably.
Oh, yes.
I'm not as sad as you about the world. That's partly because I spend quite a lot of time in the developing world. If you want to see Christian joy, the place to go is Africa.
Of course, certainly.
Have you been?
No.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's amazing to me when I see pictures of Africans, native Africans, they're always smiling. They're the poorest continent in the world, and they smile the most.
Yes, they do. The children in particular are wonderful. I got a prayer letter from my daughter this morning, and she's on her way back to Canada at the moment. But they had a dinner. She and her husband had picked up over 100 abandoned children and brought them up in the last, well, it must be 25 years or more. And one of the things they did before they'll be still going backwards and forwards, but they're handing over to African leadership. They had 33 of their orphans come to dinner with them, bringing their spouses and their children. And there's a picture of exactly the point you're making. The children, there's two kids wearing Tim Hortons shirts, with a huge grin on their face, you know. And it is so beautiful at that stage, but they lose it. And I think it's fatalism that kills it. I love the fact that Lewis begins Mere Christianity with children talking to one another and showing that they have written on their hearts ideas of justice.
Yeah, that's not fair.
That's right. And you could write a book on that title. You should do so one day. But The children...
I remember, by the way, autobiographical incident for that. When we first had kids, we agonized a little bit over the question of war and violence and should we give them machine guns or something to play with. And we said, well, we're not going to make a point of it, but we're not going to give our kids guns. And we noticed our kids, like most other kids in the neighborhood, Newton, where we live, is a very liberal place, and there are a few gun toys among the kids. They made their own guns out of tree branches. And that didn't disturb us that much, but we said, well, it's natural for kids to fight. And then we listened carefully to the kind of games they were playing. They were moral games, cops and robbers. The cops always win, the robbers always lose. And each day, you have to take a turn at being the robber in order to be the cop the next day. They play justice games.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
And yet our intellectuals seem to have ripped up our moral motherboard. That notion of an innate conscience is almost gone from the intellectuals.
You have to ask questions to get it back, you know. And of course,
yes,
with pediatricians, you can do it easily because they all relate to the not fair story because they've seen it. And I think stories about children are one of the most effective means of bringing the faith back into focus, because there is a desperation out there now. The emptiness, the flatness. I mean, I read an incredible figure from Britain that 75% of the kids don't think there's any future for them.
50% of American teenage girls seriously contemplate suicide. 50%.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And all in our lifetime. And if Jesus
so fast, so fast, yes.
So incredibly fast, yeah. But if Jesus is right, and I presume he is, he says we're to blame. I think that's what, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt
loses
its savor.
Well, God's certainly not to blame.
We're not salty enough, are we, basically?
No, we're afraid. We're cowards.
We forget. I have to tell audiences, look, when Jesus says you are the salt of the earth, he's not talking about salt as you know it. He's talking about rock salt. The Latin word for which is salare, from which we get salary. You could be paid in salt. That's how valuable it was. It wasn't for taste. It was for preservation of the good and destruction of the bad. So the housewife would go to the market to buy some salt at the beginning of the winter to salt down fish and meat, and she'd taste the top of the sack to make sure that it was salty, and a good business man would make sure that it was. But rock salt has only got a small percentage of sodium chloride and a lot of other salts that don't have any function that's useful to us. So if that sack had stood outside his shop and there'd been a downpour, the bottom of the sack would have got leached out if the water had come up the sack. Sodium chloride's gone. So she would start layering her salt and you get tired of tasting it. So she trusts it. And then a few weeks later, there's a very nasty smell. The question is simple. Do you blame the salt or do you blame the fish and the meat? And the answer is simple too. So we are responsible for keeping standards up and being very clear about what is wrong.
And we are also responsible for appealing to the true standards rather than the successful standards of the world. Status envy, I think, has done an immense amount of harm in American education. In order to get ranking in the U.S. News and World Report as one of the best colleges, you have to compromise your religious identity. You can't offend people. You have to be like Jesus. Never offend anybody. Be a nice guy.
Yeah, sure. That's the model of niceness for us, isn't it? A well-made cloth is a nice cloth, well-bound, all held together. But you write every now and again an article on colleges you might send your children to if they were of that age, that you still name some.
Almost all of them small Catholic colleges, like Thomas Aquinas or Ave Maria or Franciscan University of Steubenville. University of Dallas is almost the only large university that's still authentically Catholic.
Really? Yeah. I think there's a growth on the evangelical end of interest. I was at the New St. Andrews University just about a month ago. Craig took me there. Now I'd heard
in,
of the...
In St. Andrews in Scotland?
No, in Moscow, Idaho, of all places.
Ah.
And it was like stepping back into the 1950s.
Yes, yes.
Boys opened the doors for girls and girls said, thank you.
My goodness.
I think,
and how I revolutionary.
Think about
how sexist.
Yes.
How oppressive. How insulting to women.
And about 80% of them are likely to be engaged by the time they finish 4 years.
Yes. At Wyoming Catholic College, students are forbidden to have cell phones on campus. And many of them refuse to enter because of that. But all graduating seniors, when polled, say that's one of the best things about the place. We live in the real world.
We were so blessed that you probably had to put up with television. I didn't even have a television when I was growing up. And that simply meant that I lived in my own secondary world that had been created for me by people like Lewis and others, all the classic children's stories.
Well, I think, even older than you are, and I remember that in my childhood, we invented our own games. And we were very inventive. We weren't organized. There was no Little League. We played pickup baseball and basketball and football and everything else. And now they have to control even kids' creativity. This is how you are creative, follow these rules.
Yeah. The most important thing in my life was my bike. And I traveled thousands of miles on that bike.
And your parents trusted you. There were no terrorists. There were no sex perverts around to harm you.
I got as far as Vienna.
Wow. From where?
Before I went, from Birmingham in England. And before I went to university, then I started rock climbing, and that finished the bike, you know. But growing up, every year, and it was, Tom Sowell makes a similar comment about this, you could get a job because there were no minimum wage, so you could go to a farm and say, I want to earn this much money, and the farmer would look at you and say, I'll pay you that. And so you agreed, you got the money for your trip, and you worked for him till you went. Minimum wage makes that illegal. And as Tom Sowell points out, what it means is that when he was a boy, black boys were more likely to have a job than white boys because they came from poorer backgrounds. Now they can't get a job, and we all know what that will lead to. And their father's out of the picture as well. But I could go all the way to Vienna, and all I had to do, the only deal was I had to write a postcard every day. And they would get to Birmingham within 2 days. If you posted a postcard in London or Birmingham at 9 o'clock in the morning, it would be delivered by midday. The world has not got better in all these ways. Amazingly, when my mother died, I discovered all my postcards. I didn't know I'd been to Liechtenstein, but I had.
Well, we didn't go that far, but we went all around the neighborhood, and we were following the fire trucks and the police cars and getting into mild trouble, as kids are supposed to do.
Yeah, mine, I was much more of a, I would leave the other kids and take off on my bike and wander all over Warwickshire from between my home and Stratford-upon-Avon. I was born in Birmingham, but literally the last row of houses. So the bottom of the garden, you stepped into Worcestershire, which is where Sam comes from in Tolkien's books. He's based on a Worcestershire gardener. So Worcestershire and Warwickshire are very outside of the industrial area in Warwickshire, very, very beautiful. And I could ride to Stratford-upon-Avon down Icknell Street, which was built by the Romans. And it hadn't been surfaced since the Romans when I went down it. Then we redid it, and it's been redone three times since then. It was a bit rough, but it was a lovely route. And, you know, you had history right there beside you. I'd pass a Saxon church with a 5'6" doorway. People forget the Roman legions were on average about 5'6". And you could look at history. I passed Gunpowder Plot at Houghton Hall, and Anne Hathaway's birthplace. Got to Shakespeare's house in Stratford and then turned around and came back. And I could do it in a couple of hours. A lovely ride every spring, many other times. But that sort of thing is not happening now in the same way.
Not only because we're not here in America, a nation of old history as you were in England, but because our tradition goes back about 5 or 10 years to rock stars and actors and actresses and so on, and they're known very well, but nothing beyond that. I had one student tell me once that history ended with the assassination of Kennedy. He was serious.
Oh, dear. Did you give him your book?
No. Well, actually, this was a course in C.S. Lewis, and I remember it was a very articulate student, and he wrote to me that when he read The Problem of Pain, which gives you the traditional answer to why God deliberately allows us pain, namely for our own good, he said he used to stand that book up on his dormitory window and throw his socks at it.
Wow. So he got to him in a way.
It got to him. He hated it, but he suspected it was the truth and didn't like it. That's a good reaction. I was pleased that I had ticked him off successfully.
I agree with you entirely, yeah. The best person to talk to apologetically is a really serious atheist. They're vulnerable and they don't know it. I want to push you a bit further in another direction slightly, because I want to see what you say, really. I went off to university from King Edward's School in Birmingham, where I'd got a scholarship. So when I was for high school, I was translated from the back streets of Birmingham to one of the six best schools in England. Tolkien was at King Edward's School a generation before me, and such was the school that he hardly went to school in the final year, but they all knew where he was down the street in Barrow's coffee shop teaching himself Icelandic, so they left him alone. He only got an exhibition instead of a open scholarship, which he would have got at Oxford otherwise. Anyway, I was translated into that area as a result of affirmative action on a very small scale. The school had no funding from the state that it took any that brought any responsibility with it. But the local government, which was Labour, of course, in an industrial city, gave money to the school because they were proud of its outcome. I mean, in those days, 3 or 4% of people went to university. But everybody who wanted to go to university from King Edward's went, because I got to my first homeroom master and he spoke 5 languages. And I thought, well, wow, what happens here? And what happened was an education without me knowing it, of course, which was wonderful. I then went off to university and was totally unprepared in one way for what was going to happen to me. And I didn't even get the name for it for a long while. I became a reductionist without knowing it, a scientific reductionist.
There's a natural reason for that, I think, because people who teach in university are usually smarter than other people, and therefore they know that they're smart and they're proud. And if they can puncture the true but unproved assumptions of the masses by reducing the complex to the simple, and totally explain love as lust and thought as cerebral biochemistry and the rest of it, that flatters their arrogance. Reductionism is the philosophy of a very proud and arrogant person. I see through this stuff more than you do.
I go back to Ockham, because Ockham got to me. And do you look upon him as an important character in this story?
I do. Luther very significantly was an Ockhamist and labeled him as such. And therefore, W.H. Auden wrote these lines: accurate scholarship can trace the whole offense from Luther until now that has driven our culture mad. And he wasn't talking about justification by faith. He was talking about nominalism.
Yes, yes. Yeah, which is what it started as.
There are no essences. There are no natures. There is nothing natural. We are God. We create our own nature. That's basically Ockham. So Ockham is the father of the transgender
and yet
movement.
He was a Franciscan.
Well, so is the Pope, or means to be.
He might get excommunicated for that.
Well, I think Jesuits and Franciscans have something in common. Some of them are very, very good and very, very wise and very, very holy, and some of them are quite heretics.
I think Jesuits in particular, you don't meet, they're either very good or very bad. The one that's influenced me most is Robert Spitzer.
Oh, yes. He's a great one.
Who I love.
Yes.
I have a book on my shelf.
Stanley Jocke is another one. He's basically the forerunner to Spitzer.
Yeah. Spitzer's 4 levels of happiness, which I learned from him many years ago. And then after hearing him for the first time at a conference, a small one, I said to him, that was brilliant, but those Greek words will upset most people. Can I write an earthy version of that suitable for medical students? And he, of course, said, yes, he's a wonderful guy. Much so I did. And then one of these wonderful godlike stories happened. Slowly I was coming awake to my duties to tell what the Lord had done in my life, so to speak. And I was doing apologetics. for medical students in various places across the continent. And one of the places I got to was another place that I had very low opinion of until I went there, and that was Focus on the Family. I came away very much in awe of what James Dobson had done and became a regular there. Anyway, on one occasion, I was teaching the four levels of happiness, and unbeknownst to me, there were two Catholic doctors in the audience. And they went back to their Jesuit priest and taught him the four levels of happiness as an apologetic scheme. And he started spending one Sunday every 6 weeks or so in another church teaching them the four levels of happiness.
Well, you know why that idea is so striking and apparently original, because it's utterly unoriginal. It's totally traditional.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
The book that in my rather extensive course through the history of philosophy, two-semester double-credit course, the students find the most original of all is Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy, which until the fifth chapter is utterly unoriginal and simply a synthesis of classical wisdom.
Yeah, but once they hear how he was killed, they can never forget him.
But in an age where everything has been tried, the most radical thing is tradition and orthodoxy.
That's why I love Chesterton too. You know, he understands that, and you can get a lot of people going with Chesterton.
Many of them hate him. I find some students are very threatened by him because, of course, he turns you upside down because you're already upside down, so he's standing you on your head.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, my favorite character, I think, is Innocent Smith. I love the scene where he gets the teacher of Kant sitting on a gargoyle shouting to the whole university, "Life is good."
Was that The Flying Inn?
No.
Who was that?
You haven't
Napoleon
read this?
Of Notting Hill? One of his
No. If you haven't read it, you would absolutely love it. It is a bit of obscure Chesterton. I had a friend who collected virtually everything by Chesterton, and he introduced me to him. But the story is simply of Innocent Smith, lovely Chestertonian name, and he spends one morning listening, I guess, to Kant or something like that. And in the evening, he's looking at his notes, and then he gets up and he goes to the bureau and takes out a pistol. And he walks across the campus and he sees the light is on in the professor's room. So he goes up and knocks on the door. He goes in. He's sipping his port. And he says, what can I do for you, young man? And he said, I was going through my notes of today's lecture, and he gives an account of life ultimately has no future, no meaning. Yes, my boy, quite right. You've got the message appropriately. Well, he said, sir, I've come to put you out of your misery. And he pulls out the pistol. And he goes, no. And he backs him across the room onto the balcony. He ends up sitting on a gargoyle facing the university campus and shouting, "Life is good."
That's not Kant. That's Sartre.
Yes,
Sartre
it is.
Goes one more step. He has a character in his novel Nausea who contemplates suicide, and he eventually rejects it because if everything is meaningless, suicide is meaningless too.
What's next on your, if you have one, what would you be telling students today? You know, you've got presumably some grandchildren going to university now. I've got 20 or more of them there, or going through or gone through or on the way there. It's a very dangerous place. What advice do you give to students?
The most important word, I think, is pray. One loses one's religion when one ceases to pray. And when one loses one's religion, one loses one's substantive morality and consequent psychological happiness.
So who do you recommend as a teacher for prayer after our Lord?
Oh my, it's a different kind of thing than can be taught. I greatly respect the great mystics and experts in prayer, like St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa, but I've been helped much more by the simplest books, like Brother Lawrence's The Practice of the Presence of God, and de Caussade's Abandonment to Divine Providence.
Yeah.
Simple
ideas.
What
about Bonhoeffer? Do you read Bonhoeffer?
No.
Life Together. was very helpful to me.
I haven't. No, some of the Protestant evangelicals are excellent. They can teach us something.
Don't be so surprised. They love the
Lord, too. No, I'm not. In fact, when I was a kid, everyone I knew was a Dutch Calvinist, and we were in either the Reformed or the Christian Reformed Church. And I must have known about 50 families, and I didn't know a single divorce in any one of those families. Today, I know about 50 families, and they're all Catholic, and there's not a single family that doesn't have a divorce in it, although Catholics do not believe in divorce, and Protestants do.
We do.
That's astonishingly ironic. Oh, you're Canadian. Well, you're Canadian, so first.
No. I mean, we had our 50th wedding anniversary a little while back, or maybe it was 50th, I think, yeah. And we don't celebrate very. We're not very good at celebrations, Sally and I. But the children said, "You have to celebrate this." So we said, "Well, we've got little ones. It has to be at the farm." And we had a lovely day. Everybody there was from our family and its extended family, and there were about 50 people in the garden, and they included my missionary children from Malawi who got there. There was only one grandchild who didn't get there. And David, the missionary from Malawi, is a good photographer, and he spent a lot of time taking pictures. And he sent us a set of them afterwards. And as I went through them, they reduced me to tears because I suddenly realized no one in that garden that afternoon had gone through divorce. And to get 50 people together without that experience, that's an act of grace, isn't it?
And yes.
Grace is the one thing that really moves me deeply. I've been in many tragic situations and dealt with tragedies in medical and other ways, and I won't shed a tear in that environment. I get on and do triage or whatever's necessary. But when grace erupts into someone's life, I start crying. I can't stop myself.
Yeah.
And I think in a way that's very good for people to see, because it's obviously completely genuine. And I think we need to major in grace at that level and to tell the story in a way that makes it plain that I can't give an explanatory story. I don't know the mechanism of my salvation. I can't even, in my case, put a date to it. I doubt whether you can, because I never disbelieved the story. It was written on my heart from day one onwards. And I was always smart enough to see any other story doesn't have the explanatory power, certainly in the context of medicine. And one had so many great missionary doctors who were such impressive people. And I think that's the only way I know to go nowadays.
Well, I think that's the most effective argument for the existence of God, because if life is meaningful, we're in a story. And if there is a story, there's a storyteller, and we are not the storytellers. With the characters.
It does work. And now in science, of course, we have an amazing moment, really. The first realization for me came some years ago in Cuba, of all places. I've been to Cuba to teach a dozen times, probably, because Canada didn't break relations. And a very smart Christian doctor realized there were Christian doctors in Cuba, and they weren't getting any updating, and so they hatched a plan to have a conference, and Castro gave his personal blessing so we could have a Canadian Cuban Christian medical doctors meeting. The first time I went along, it was all about medicine, and I said, "We're all Christian doctors, surely there should be something about what is unique about being a Christian doctor." And they said, "Could you do that?" I said, "Yeah, I could do that." So I did that regularly thereafter. And then it must have been the second or third year. I'd given a lecture on some obscure aspect of renal physiology and medicine. And afterwards, a gentleman came up to see me, and he turned out to be the head of the Department of Marxism and Leninism in the local university. And I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I've come to see you." "Why?" And he said, "The students tell me that you say Russia rotted from the inside. It was not brought down by Reaganomics." "And I agree with you," he said. When I saw that Russia was going to collapse, I stopped teaching Marxism and Leninism because I saw that Russia was falling into the hands of the mafia, Well, we'd been there in the past. We don't want to go back there. So I thought teaching ethics would help. So I tried to teach multicultural ethics. But the students go to sleep. But they tell me they don't go to sleep when you teach ethics. I know that you believe that without God there are no ethics. I want to learn the argument. I know you're still here tomorrow morning. Will you debate me in front of the faculty on the nature of ethics?
How wonderfully honest.
I don't mind losing. Well, what happened next was you couldn't write it as fiction. I, of course, said yes and spent the evening wondering which of many starts I would use and saying my prayers. But every now and again, the good Lord reminds me who's actually in charge. As I got up from the lectern to walk the six steps from my seat to walk to the lectern, he wiped my mind clean of everything I'd done the night before. And he put one sentence in there. So I said to my translator, right on the blackboard in Spanish, this message assembled itself. And even while he was doing it, I suddenly realized where this was going. And I'd never seen it before. It had nothing to do with me. It was pure gift. And I asked the audience, if you'd come into the room and found this on the blackboard, what would you make of it? And they engaged and they said, well, it's a sentence, but it's nonsense because messages require people. And I said, quite right. And then I turned out, crossed out the word message and put DNA in its place. And I said, but you do believe this sentence because Darwin told you so. But don't you see, DNA is not you and me. DNA is a blueprint for you and me. It's a coded blueprint. Which do you think was the right decision, the first one or the second? The whole audience burst into applause. I'd won the debate. They could see that I was going to take apart scientific socialism, which is what they thought they were doing. But the fact that we have in us, every cell in your body has a 2-meter stretch of DNA. You have a 3.1 billion letter ID number. Good job you don't have to write it out. It can copy itself with virtually no errors. It has a correcting mechanism. And the errors are probably not errors either, in my view, in seconds. We can't come close to anything like that. And God only needs 4 letters in his alphabet, and he only writes 3-letter words. And more than that, he can overwrite so that in the same stretch of paper, so to speak, reading in triplets, he can start at number 1 and number 2 and get 1,000 in the same order, which is what you need for the average protein. And they both read sense. When Bill Gates was shown that, he said, I can't believe it. We wouldn't have any clue how to write that. But there it is, sitting in every cell in our body.
There it is, yeah.
And that DNA is basically, you will not hear a discussion about Darwin in a molecular biology lab, ever. Nobody has any interest in it anymore. They make a little nod on the first page of their grant application. They have no interest in Darwin. He's useless.
Similarly in cosmology, when Big Bang cosmology was first broached, it was laughed at.
Yes.
It was an insulting name.
Yeah.
And now everyone accepts it.
Yeah.
And yet that does not transform the culture, and it does not even transform many intellectual minds.
It is transforming some. Don't give up. Don't give up.
Yes, it's there. It's data, and it's a stone wall that if we get close to it, we can bat against it with our heads and change our heads. But we're not going to get that close to it.
I think we will get there. This you would love listening to, and you can find him easily on YouTube if you can do that. James Tour and Stephen Meyer, they did an apologetics conference in Dallas a little while back. James Tour is one of the best chemists in the world. And he's actually at the moment pushing very hard, saying to the chemists who do origin of life research, you've been doing it for 50 years, you've achieved nothing, and we know why now. And he gives a lecture on apologetics. He says, this is a Christian apologetics lecture, but I'm not going to mention God at any point. I'm going to let God speak for himself. And he's a wonderful teacher. And he shows the extreme difficulty of making a single organic molecule from an inorganic source.
Yep.
So the two steps, the DNA code and the incredible difficulty, the chemistry of going inorganic to organic, anybody with any honesty has to admit this cannot happen by chance.
Well, you know, the Hebrew word for create, bara, which does not exist in any other ancient language, is used only three times in the Genesis creation account, for the creation of matter, for the creation of life, and the creation of man.
That's making the point for you, isn't it?
And yet, that is not, I find, as effective an apologetic argument as the more personal or practical or moral argument, like C.S. Lewis's argument from Desire. I once had to teach at the Berklee College of Music, and the students there were all brilliant, but they didn't want to take philosophy, but they had to. So they were bored with most philosophy until we got to the question of morality and God. And I briefly went through the arguments for atheism and for theism, and they were not very impressed until I got to C.S. Lewis's argument from Desire. And at least half the class said, oh, that's it. That's it. There's got to be something better than...
You can't have desire with no object of desire.
Yes, and they were all passionate, at least about their music. So they experienced desire. They were not cold clods.
No.
Sometimes the debauched rebel is much closer to conversion than the proper intellectual.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Especially the snobby ones. Yeah, who don't recognize their own fallibilities and nonsenses. I don't understand why people aren't in awe of everything that's created. The more you look at it, the more awesome it becomes.
Because we are perhaps even systematically taught not to allow that initial impression of awe and wonder to emerge, because if it does, it's going to lead you nowhere, to the God who is the enemy. So reductionism is the cap that's put on that wonder and that awe. It's X is only Y. We can explain it all.
And yet they love all these fancy movies, which are basically doing miracles the whole time, without realizing what the parallel is, that there's a miracle around them all the while that they don't see.
Well, the devil's got a pretty clever propaganda team.
Yeah.
That aspect of the heart is kept insulated from the mind. We still love our superheroes, but we don't believe in them.
And the trouble with Jesus is that you can't do it that way. Yeah.
Well, Jesus is a figure that it's impossible to imitate. There has never been good Jesus fiction. The Protestants keep trying to write good Jesus fiction. It's astonishingly bad. It's embarrassingly bad. And they can do a fairly good job with anybody else, Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or Confucius. Take any historical figure at all. You can have very good historical novels about him. There has never been a reasonable historical novel about Jesus. The closest anyone ever came was C.S. Lewis's Aslan in The Chronicles of Narnia. And he's a lion, not a man, and he's in Narnia, not Earth.
Yes, yes. And the lovely thing about that is how long it takes children to see it.
Oh, children see it very quickly, much more quickly than adults do. Lewis got a number of letters from students, from children, saying, yeah, I feel guilty. I love Aslan more than I love Jesus.
but then they see, oh, Aslan is Jesus.
It is Jesus, yes. Not an allegory for it, but...
My missionary daughter didn't get it till the last book.
Really?
I read the whole thing to her, and even the stone table, she didn't make the connections. It was only when Lucy says, in our world too, the whole world was in a stable once.
Ah, and that's at the end of the Voyage of the Orange Rider.
Aslan is Jesus, yeah.
Yes.
And it
yes.
was lovely that she didn't get it till that point, because she loved the story on her own right.
Lewis's achievement is that he enables us to spontaneously feel towards Aslan what is almost impossible for us to spontaneously feel towards Jesus and the Gospels, because it's so familiar. By making it unfamiliar, he drills it home to us.
But he can and does do that to us, doesn't he?
He does.
one lives on those moments in many ways. They're only moments, but they are so real. I mean, the most striking one in my life was the result of the Rwanda war. I had a project running on the borders of Rwanda in what was then the DRC for about 10 years to do with malnourished children. And so we were there. Actually, we were walking through the Itumbi Mountains where there are no roads. Absolutely beautiful place, very few people. We had to sleep out a couple of nights on a seven-day walk. But we took a shortwave radio with us, and Sally was on the board of World Relief Canada, and we heard that the war between the Tutsi and the Hutu, which had been smouldering for a couple of years, had broken out big time in Kigali. And so when we got back, Sally went up to see what was happening, and she was there before the UN on the bridge with my son, who was just about to go to university, when the refugees came flooding over. It was total chaos. And then they had an outbreak of cholera. Thousands of people died. But I knew she wasn't going to be coming back, because there were seven-year-olds trying to look after four-year-olds. And I had no prior rights over them. She loved children. So she spent 2 years running refugee camps. Once the UN discovered who they'd got on their hands, they let her free. And she broke the UN's rules, like trying to give these people meaning and getting their lives back, giving them some dignity, etc., etc. But I went out to see her. In those days, there was no email and no contact, but that's another miracle that happened beforehand. We were given peace over the whole time. Neither of us ever worried. But I went out after a year to see her, and my research was in ruins, but she knows I don't suffer from jet lag, so she said, "Oh, by the way, you're talking to the leaders of my camps this morning, first morning in Africa." And I said, "Sally, you don't mean that." And she said, "Yeah, you're exactly what they need." No point in arguing, so off I went. And we talked for about 3 hours, and then we got to the question. As you see, 80% of Rwandans go to church. Roughly half Catholic, half evangelical.
95% in Nigeria, I hear.
I've been there too, but that's rather different in my view. Anyway, we got to the question, how is it possible that we who call ourselves Christian ended up killing people we knew? It's a good question. And providentially, I'd been set up for it in part by David Jeffrey, my friend from Baylor now, who was a co-founder of Augustine College. He'd written a nice account of the reconversion of Britain under Gregory, when Britain was worse than Rwanda in terms of what was going on. So I said, "Look, welcome to the club. All groups have done this at various times. Nobody's immune from something like the Rwanda war happening to them. We're all fallen sinners. Only Christians have an answer to that. So first let me tell you what other places were like so that you don't feel so badly about it. But then I think you need to deepen your understanding of what salvation means. You need to think a lot more about discipleship, and you really seriously need to think about how to be fathers." And they said, "Would you do that?" Now, I'd been in Africa a lot. I knew I should say how many times I was willing to do that. But I'd actually said in my prayers when I got there, "Lord, I'm not good when I don't have something to do. Would you give me something to do this summer?"
A very dangerous prayer.
And he did. I spent 2 months, because I'd had to deal with the dean at the medical school, that I would spend 2 months a year in Africa and take students with me every now and again. As long as he didn't bother me, I wouldn't bother him, and I wouldn't bother applying for promotion because I didn't want the administration. And he said, "That's a good deal." So I spent every other day for 2 months teaching in the refugee camps. I was in tears, and they were in tears, and I felt his pleasure. That lovely line from Chariots of Fire, where Eric is off running and his sister thinks he's losing his faith, and he takes her out. He's late for Sunday school that he's supposed to be teaching. And he puts his hands on Jenny's shoulders and he says, "Jenny, I'm going to China with you. He died in the concentration camps. But God made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. Well, God made me articulate. And that summer was the first time I gave the gift back to the giver.
I doubt that it was the first time, but it was a spectacular time.
It was a spectacular time. The rest of the world has nothing to compare with that. Absolutely nothing. But how do we make it clearer?
By starting from the within. Our world is overrun with these problems, 1,000 problems. And almost always the solution is from without. This is what the government can do. This is the plan. This is the method that'll work. This is the scientifically approved means to this end.
Reductive.
And it looks good on paper. And then you get these fallen, selfish, morally compromised human beings, these jackasses like ourselves, who implement it and the thing falls apart. The only alternative is to do what you do, to start with prayer, to start with opening your heart to God and saying, I'm an idiot, but use me anyway. I give you a blank check. Nothing else matters. And then he'll use you in ways that astonish you, both for their apparent weirdness and sometimes cruelty, and for their unpredictable success.
Is that the way your writing came about?
Not consciously until later, but unconsciously, yes. I remember the first profound idea I ever had, and I was about 8 years old, and I think every other idea I've ever had after that is a fall away from this. I went to Sunday school and learned Bible stuff, and nothing heretical or wrong about it, but I was kind of confused, like most kids, and I remember riding home from church with my father and my mother in the car. And I remember the exact place where it was. I turned to my father, who was driving, and said, Dad, all this stuff that they teach you in Sunday school, I had been especially confused that Sunday morning, it all comes down to only one thing, doesn't it? And he looked at me rather suspiciously and said, just one thing? No, there's a lot of things. It's all important. What do you mean, just one thing? And I said, as I see it, all we have to do is ask Jesus what he wants us to do and then do it. What else is there? And then he looked at me again, and there was a change in his look, and he said, you know, son, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah. Go tell what the Lord has done.
It's that simple.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this morning. I hope you have too.
So have I.
So yes. God bless you, and thank you so much.
God bless you, Doctor, and thank you so much.